Tonight, we are going to be looking at the future for Israel. We're going to be talking about Israel's future. And I do not mean the church's future, because Micah is about the nation of Israel. That's what Micah is about. Micah is not about the church. Amillennialists, postmillennialists would like us to believe that, but the descriptions are just too incredible to think that these are things that are happening now or are going to happen in the distant future here on earth. So this is about the future of Israel. And what Micah chapter 4 and chapter 5 are is encouragements to Israel. Both chapters are an encouragement from God to Israel, and it has some patriotic overtones to it. And when I say patriotic overtones, it's that Israel is going to be defeated, and yet God is saying, there's a great future for Israel. And in reality, the people who are going to be taken into captivity, they will never see that event. They will never see the future. So in a sense, it has patriotic overtones. That is, that the nation is going to have a great future. This is not about America. This is about Israel. And what we're going to be seeing is that he's going to remind them that the Messiah is coming. And the Messiah is going to bring Israel into, so to speak, its limelight. And it's going to be the Messianic kingdom that is in focus, that is being talked about. So that's basically where our study is headed. But before I get into our study tonight, I want to take a few minutes to provide an outline of chapters 4 and 5 of Micah so that you will see a flow of the book and better understand what this prophecy is doing in these two chapters. Okay? What we saw in our last study in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 8, is that it was about the millennial kingdom. The millennial kingdom was promised in a number of passages in the Old Testament. One of them we referred to was Genesis chapter 49, verse 10. And there it said, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until Shiloh, and to him shall be the obedience of the people. So the key statement was, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff. And it actually indicates a future event about a coming king, someone who would rule Israel. In Numbers chapter 24, verse 17, there's another prophecy about the coming Messiah. I see him, but not now. That sounds right, doesn't it? I see him, but not now. In other words, I know he's coming. He hasn't shown up yet. I behold him, but not near. That is, he's far away. A star shall come forth from Jacob, a scepter shall arise from Israel. So talking about the future. In 2 Samuel chapter 17, verses 16 and 17, we saw this last time. Your house and your kingdom shall endure before me forever, and your throne shall be established forever. So those were promises about a king. Promises about a coming kingdom, and that's what Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 8 were about, if you remember. We talked about the lion. We talked about different animals being able to be together, a child being able to put his hand into the hole of a cobra or a snake and not be bit. I mean, that's a millennial kingdom. And most of our study last time was just a discussion about the millennial kingdom, what it was like, and what we saw in verse 1 of Micah 4, is that it was described as being the mountain of the house of the Lord. And we were told it will be established as the chief of the mountains. And so it was talking about the millennial kingdom. In verses 9 through 10, we saw a promise of restoration. In verse 9, we read this, now why do you cry out loudly? Is there no king among you, or has your counselor perished that agony has gripped you like a woman in childbirth? I mean, the verse reveals that they got the message that judgment was coming, and he asked the question, why do you cry out? Why do you cry out loudly? Why are you doing that? And the reason that the question is posed is that God has promised them a great future. Promised them about a kingdom, promised them about a coming king. And so the question is like, aren't you trusting? Aren't you trusting the Lord who's going to take care of you? Aren't you trusting? And that is really what's being described here. Verse 10 talks about the coming battle. And then in verse 11, it segues, it jumps, it catapults to the future. And in verse 11, it says, and now many nations have been assembled against you. And we made the point last time that this is really talking about Armageddon. Because when Armageddon occurs, nations of the world are going to come against Israel. I mean, it isn't just the Assyrian army that's coming, or the Babylonian army that's coming, or the Medo-Persian army that's coming. It's the nations of the world that are coming against Israel. I mean, all of them are coming. Turn to Joel. Go left in your Bible. And if you pass Daniel or Hosea, you went too far, so back up, go right. But Joel chapter 3. Joel chapter 3 describes the tribulation period. And you'll see that in verse 1. So Joel 3 verse 1 says, for behold, in those days and at that time, when I restore the fortunes of Judah and Jerusalem. Now, in that opening verse, God says, there's going to come a day when I'm going to restore your fortunes. There's going to come a day for Israel, you're going to come back together. And it's going to be great. I mean, that is the message of verse 1. But now watch verse 2. And I will gather all the nations and bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And then I will enter into judgment with them there on behalf of my people and my inheritance, Israel, whom they have scattered among the nations, and they have divided up my land. And they have also cast lots for my people and traded a boy for a harlot and sold a girl for wine that they may drink. So verse 3 describes abuse of boys and girls, abuse of people in general. But verse 2 is really important. What's the Valley of Jehoshaphat? Valley of Jehoshaphat is where Armageddon occurs. That's where it actually occurs. And what does verse 2 says that God's going to do? God says, I will gather what? How many nations? All the nations. And bring them down to the valley of Jehoshaphat. And then I will enter into judgment with them there. What does that mean? He's going to defeat them. And the next statement says, and on behalf of my people and my inheritance. I find this interesting. That God says that Israel is his inheritance. Did you know in the New Testament that Christians are referred to as being God's inheritance? Think about that for a minute. Did you know that God considers you his inheritance? I mean, that's pretty special. I don't know if you are interested in an inheritance. People usually are interested in inheritances. And God says Israel is his inheritance and we Christians are his inheritance. And then he says, and they have scattered them throughout the nations, and we know that's true of the Jews. When the Assyrian army came down, took away the northern kingdom, and then Babylon came in and took away the southern kingdom, in both instances, the Jews were taken and scattered all over the place, and then from there, they've scattered elsewhere. So the statement, whom they have scattered among the nations, that's the true statement, and they have divided up my land, and they have divided up his land. And today, even Israel isn't in the land that was promised to them. In fact, today, Israel is not even occupying the land that King David and King Solomon had at the time that they reigned. The footprint of the nation of Israel today is really, really small compared to what they used to have. So verse 2 is very accurate. Now go to verse 9. Proclaim this among the nations. Prepare a war, rouse the mighty men, let all the soldiers draw near, and let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords and your pruning hooks into spears, and let the weak say, I am a mighty man. In other words, get your courage up. The idea is that you're a weak man. Oh, hey, I'm really strong, and you're not, is the idea. Verse 11, hasten and come, all you surrounding nations, and gather yourselves there. Now, again, it's all the nations. It's a call to all the nations to come and gather yourselves there. Bring down, O Lord, your mighty ones. Let the nations be roused and come up to the valley of Jehoshaphat. Now, what we're reading is about Armageddon. It's a description of war. And so the nations come down, for I will sit to judge all the surrounding nations. Put in the sickle, for the harvest is ripe. Come, tread, for the winepress is full, and vats overflow, for their wickedness is great. Multitudes, multitudes in the valley of decision, for the day of the Lord is near in the valley of decision. The sun and moon grow dark, and the stars lose their brightness, and the Lord roars from Zion and utters his voice from Jerusalem, and the heavens and the earth tremble. But the Lord is a refuge for his people, a stronghold to the sons of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, dwelling in Zion, my holy, what's it say? Mountain. What's mountain symbolic of in prophecy? The millennial kingdom. And so Jerusalem will be holy, and the strangers will pass through it no more. Isn't that an interesting statement? Strangers will not pass through it anymore. Are there strangers in Jerusalem today? Yeah, sure is. There's lots of strangers. In fact, there's the Dome of the Rock right in Jerusalem. There's lots of strangers there. Lots of strangers. Then look at verse 18. And in that day the mountains will drip with sweet wine. The hills will flow with milk, and all the brooks of Judah will flow with water, and a spring will go up from the house of the Lord. And goes on, talking about the millennial kingdom. So watch this. The first part of Joel is dealing with the tribulation. At the very end, then you get the millennial kingdom. Back to Micah. What we saw in Micah chapter 4, verses 1 through 8 is a millennial kingdom. And verses 9 and 10 is an encouragement to the people. Like, why are you crying out? The idea is that you need to trust the Lord about the future. And sure, there's a nation going to come, and they're going to take you away. It's the Assyrian army and the Babylonian army, then later for Judah. And then verse 11 is like an encouragement. And it jumps to the future and it says, and many nations are going to come against you, but guess what? The Lord knows their thoughts, verse 12. In verse 13, arise and thresh, daughter of Zion, talking about Jerusalem. And says, and for your horn I will make iron, and your hooves I will make bronze, and that you may pulverize many peoples, and that you may devote to the Lord their unjust gain and their wealth to all of the earth. Verse 1, chapter 5. Now muster yourselves and troops, daughter of troops. They have laid siege against us, against Jerusalem. And with a rod they will smite the judge of Israel on the cheek. That's the leader of Israel. In verse 1, the leader dies. And if you were a Jew, and you were in the tribulation period, and all the nations have come against you, and you're in a battle, and you lose your leader, that would be a disappointment. No, try it again. That would be discouragement. You lose your leader. So what Micah is doing is encouraging the Israelites. He says, hey, there's a millennial kingdom coming. Then he jumps and he says, like, so why are you crying? Why are you in anguish? And he says, well, think about the future. All the nations are going to come against you. And oh yes, and you are going to lose your leader. Now, how do you encourage the Israelites? You're going to lose your leader during this great battle that the Lord is going to help you with. What he does is he focuses on the Messiah, verse 2. And he says, and now as for you, Bethlehem of Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. You know what he does? Is he focuses on the Prince of Peace who is coming. So you lost your leader, right? And you're in the tribulation period, and Armageddon is occurring, right? All the nations are coming against you and you lose your leader. So how does the prophet encourage Israel? The Messiah is coming. That's how you encourage Israel. And then what he will do is he'll make the point that Israel will come back into the land and the king will establish peace. So that's essentially our chapter. So Micah chapter 5 has three basic divisions to it. The promise of the Prince of Peace that's coming, a statement that Israel's coming back to the land you've just gotten through being scattered, and then he's going to describe the establishment of peace. And so chapters 4 and chapter 5 are an encouragement to Israel that they have a tremendous future. How would you feel if you had the idea that America was going to, say, in 10 years, cease to exist? How would you feel? Be a little discouraged, disappointed, wondering what's going to happen. How would you feel if God said America might go through some difficult times, but it has a glorious future down the road? How would you feel? You feel a little encouraged. You might not be part of it, but you feel a lot better, right? Think about Israel. That's what God just did. That's what Micah just did. He just encouraged Israel. They have a glorious future, and the Messiah is going to help you in the final battle. You might lose this battle here, but the future battle, and you lose your leader, but Messiah is going to come and defeat the armies of the world. He's going to help you do that, and he's going to establish peace. Israel has a fabulous future. That's the message of Micah chapter 4 and 5. So let's get into the chapter now. We took a fair amount of time just giving you the overview, but I think it helps you understand what 4 and 5 are trying to accomplish. Otherwise, it just looks piecemeal. Otherwise, it looks disconnected. And I wanted you to see that it's not disconnected. There's a flow to the two chapters, okay? So what I want to do now, I want to start with verse 2, but before I do that, I just want to make a couple of important points. The book of Micah was written about 700 BC. Now, the reason that this is important is because verse 2 is about a prophecy. The prophecy is fulfilled right around 1 BC or 81, depending upon how you want to count things, okay? And what's important is that Micah was written 700 BC or 700 years before the prophecy that we're going to see in verse 2 is fulfilled. Now, some people have said, well, Micah is written after the fact. Micah is written after the prophecy, so it's actually just recording history. Well, there's a problem with that view. First of all, is that Micah is contained in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which by conventional wisdom was written roughly 150 BC, maybe the closest date towards the time of Christ would be somewhere around 50 BC. So we believe that since Micah was contained in the Dead Sea Scrolls, that the prophecy actually occurred before Christ was born in Bethlehem. And that's a pretty good prophecy. I mean, that's a legitimate prophecy at that point. But it gets better because we know that it is also in the Septuagint. That's the Greek version of the Old Testament. And that was commissioned to be written in 270 BC, and it took a number of years for that to actually occur. In 270 BC, that's when it began to be written. I mean, that's incredible. So that just pushes the 150 BC date out to 270 BC, okay? What's even more interesting is that if you go to Jeremiah, Jeremiah 26, verse 8, we find that he knew about Micah. He writes about Micah, and we saw that previously in our studies. And that occurred in 586 to 570 BC, so that pushes the date even out further. So watch this. The prophecy in Micah 5:2 is a real prophecy. It occurred before Christ was born. And I've already given away what verse 2 is all about. It's actually about the birth of Christ. Okay? Also, you might be interested to know that the Jews consider Micah 5:2 to be a messianic prophecy. Now, once in a while, somebody says, well, what did the Jews think about some of these Old Testament prophecies that we say are about Jesus Christ? Well, Targum Jonathan states that Micah 5:2 is about the Messiah. He said, out of thee shall proceed in my presence the Messiah to exercise sovereignty over Israel, whose name has been called from eternity, from the days of everlasting. Now, you're going to see that in verse 2. But what did he say? He said this is about the Messiah. So the Jewish belief and our belief is that verse 2 is about the Messiah. Now, we both agree. Now, that's pretty incredible that we both agree on that, and that shouldn't be a surprise, as we're going to see in a little bit. So let's look at Micah 5:2, and we're going to pick this apart tonight, and the Lord willing, finish the chapter. But as for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. His goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. Usually what happens, we read this and we say, oh, Bethlehem Ephratah. Oh, that's nice. Bethlehem. Jesus was born in Bethlehem. I know that. Well, isn't it nice that he said Bethlehem Ephratah? Isn't that nice? You say, like, why is that nice? Well, the reason it's nice is, did you know that there are actually two cities called Bethlehem in the land of Cana? There's one in Galilee and there's another one in Judah. So if the prophecy had said, but as for you, Bethlehem, too little to be among the clans of Judah, which Bethlehem would he be talking about? You would not know. Isn't that nice that this prophecy that occurred hundreds of years, we believe at least 700 years before Christ was actually born in Bethlehem. Isn't it nice that this prophecy was so specific? Watch this. This prophecy isn't general. This prophecy isn't something you can take and squish and kind of move around to make it fit. This is so specific that if he wasn't born in Bethlehem Ephratah, you have a problem. And what he does when he says Bethlehem Ephratah, he's talking about a city that's 5 to 6 miles south of Jerusalem. What does he say? Too little to be among the clans of Judah. Did you know that in the lists of cities in the Old Testament, that Bethlehem Ephratah is usually missing? Think about this. It didn't rate enough to be put into a list. It didn't rate enough to be put into a list of cities in the Old Testament. Now, it shows up a couple times, but for the most part in the list, it's just missing. It's so insignificant, it's not even listed. And yet, that's where the Messiah is going to be born. And that's what this prophecy says. I mean, this is incredible prophecy. Unbelievable prophecy. And what do we know happened? Well, we know that in Matthew chapter 2, go to Matthew 2, not Luke 2, but Matthew 2. In Matthew 2, we read about some magi who come to Jerusalem, and what do they want? Verse 2 says, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. So these men, they come looking for the Messiah. They come looking for the king of the Jews. So verse 3 tells us that when Herod the king heard this, he was troubled. Verse 4 says he gathered together the chief priests and the scribes of the people, and he inquired of them, where was the Messiah going to be born? And the answer is what? Verse 5. And they said to him, in Bethlehem in Judea, for this is what was written by the prophet. And then what does he do? He quotes Micah chapter 5, verse 2. And you, Bethlehem, land of Judah, by no means least among the leaders. He leaves out Bethlehem Ephratah in this particular passage of Scripture. Okay? So what's this about? Well, what happens is that the Magi, they pinpoint this. And what does Luke chapter 2 tell us if you were to go to Luke chapter 2, verses 1 to 7? We're told that Jesus is born where? In Bethlehem. So Jesus is the fulfillment of this prophecy. I mean, that is incredible. You know what that tells us? That tells us that Jesus is the person being talked about here in verse 2. Micah 5:2. But as for you, Bethlehem Ephratah, too little to be among the clans of Judah. Now listen to what it says. From you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. I thought this was fascinating. He says, going to go forth for me. Who's speaking? God. God says, somebody's going to go forth, and they're going to do it for me. And why is it stated that way? I think the reason he says, go forth for me, is because he, that is the me, made all the prophecies, made all the promises about a millennial kingdom. Made promises about a Messiah, made promises about tribulation period, made promises you're going to see here in Micah chapter 5, and promises about a millennial kingdom. And so this one that's going to go forth is going to do it for me, and what is he going to be? A ruler in Israel. Now that's the fulfillment of Genesis chapter 49, verse 10. That's the fulfillment of Numbers 24, 17. That's the fulfillment of 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 16 to 17. And the fulfillment of a whole bunch of other prophecies as well, including Isaiah chapter 9, verse 6. What's Isaiah 9, 6 all about? Turn there. Some of you probably have this memorized. For a child will be born to us, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders. His name will be called, what does it say? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace, and there will be no end to the increase of his government or peace. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness from then on and forevermore. How long is it going to be? Forevermore. I mean, what an unbelievable prophecy. Now, I want you to notice a couple of things in verse 6. He says it's going to be the Mighty God. He's going to be a Prince of Peace. And in verse 6 it says, as a child is going to be born to us. What does that mean, the child's born to us? How about the word human? Does that make sense? For a child is born to us means he's going to be human. And then in the verse we find out he's also God. Like, wow, that's Jesus Christ. Right there is a statement about the fact that he's going to be God and man. Now go back to Micah 5:2. Micah 5:2, we're told, and from you one will go forth for me to be ruler in Israel. Now watch what it says. For his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity. The Hebrew word that's translated here as long ago has the idea of antiquity. It has the idea that a long time back, doesn't mean eternal, but means it's a long time back. How far back is antiquity? More than 20 years. Try like thousands of years. That's what's being described. And then when it says from the days of eternity, the Hebrew word that's translated as eternity means everlasting, eternal. Everlasting, eternal. Got a question. What human has lived forever? Everlasting. What human is eternal? The answer is none. And we all die. Right? All of us die. Scripture says, is pointed unto us to die, and after that, the judgment. Who's being described here? When it says, his goings forth are from long ago, from the days of eternity, who's being described? God. What does the verse say? In the first part of the verse, it says he's going to be born in Bethlehem, Ephratah. The last part of the verse says he's God. Guess what you have again? You have a person who is God and man, Jesus Christ. You get that in Isaiah 9:6. Same statement right here in verse 2 of Micah chapter 5. I mean, this is an incredible prophecy, because what this prophecy does, written 700 years before Jesus shows up, says he's going to be born in Bethlehem. Oh, by the way, and the city is so small, it's insignificant. And oh, by the way, and God's going to be born there. And that's the testimony of Scripture. Testimony of the apostles, testimony of the saint of the day. I mean, it just took off like wildfire. By the way, did you know that Christianity is the major religion in the world? We are the largest religion in the world. Watch this. When the match was lit, the fire went everywhere. And Satan's at work now to push it back, to snuff it out. And that's what's happening. Verse 3. When we come to verse 3 now, there's a first part of the verse, the last part of the verse in my Bible. I actually have drawn a line. The first part of it I say past, and the last part of it I say future. Because right in the middle there's a time gap. And the first part of it says, therefore he will give them up until the time when she who is in labor has borne a child. Now the question is, what is being described here? He will give them up until the time. What time? Well, what happens in verse 2 is that he's born. We know from history that he then was crucified. He came back to life. What did Jesus do near the end of his ministry? What did he say was going to happen to Israel? He prophesied that the Roman army was going to come and defeat Jerusalem. Turn to Luke chapter 21. Verse 20, Jesus says, and when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. And then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must enter the city. And he goes on, and what he ends up describing actually is that the Roman army is going to come and destroy Jerusalem. That's what's being talked about here in first part of verse 3, when he says give them up for a time. That is that Israel is going to be defeated by the Romans, and they're going to be scattered. Scattered everywhere. And then he says, and when she who is in labor has borne a child. Now you might say, like, that sounds like that's when Christ is born. Well, at first that does appear to be the case, but if you were to go to Revelation chapter 12, verses 1 to 2, turn there. This is important. Verse, you see that Israel is actually described as being a woman. That's not uncommon in the Old Testament. And it's interesting that this is a description of the future, because it says a great sign is going to appear in heaven, and we're told in verse 1 that there's a woman who's clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and she has a crown of 12 stars. But verse 2 is the important verse. It says she's with child, and she cries out in labor and pain to give birth. Now, this is a future prophecy. And you might wonder, what is it talking about? Well, what's interesting is that it connects with Micah 5, verse 3. Here in verse 3, it talks about a woman who's in labor and going to bear a child. But clearly, Revelation is talking about the future. I mean, Revelation is not talking about the past. Revelation is talking about the future, and it's a woman who is with a child and about to give birth, and that's consistent here with this verse. And what this is talking about is actually the final appearance of the Messiah. That's what it's talking about. So that's the first part of verse 3. When you come to the last part of verse 3, that is what I call 3b, now we're told that his brethren are going to come back to Israel. This now jumps us to the future, and I believe that this began in 1948. It started, I should say, in 1948, where the Jews start to come back to the land. So there's a huge time gap right in the middle of verse 3. This is not uncommon to have that happen. A big jump. In fact, you just had a big jump between verses 1 and 2. Did you realize that? Verse 1 is talking about the tribulation period, and then verse 2, it jumps you way back in time. Jumps you all the way back to the birth of Christ. And so there's a big time gap between verses 1 and 2, and here's the big time gap right in the middle of verse 3. And at the end of verse 3, it says, and then the remainder of his brethren will return to the sons of Israel. So the idea is that they're coming back to the land. Today, what do we know about Jews? They're scattered all over. I looked at some statistics not too long ago as to where Jews were, what country they were in, and interestingly enough, the United States is the largest gathering of Jews in the world, even more than Israel. More Jews here in the United States than any place else. And then as you start looking at the countries, it's Europe and then other areas, and it starts dropping off, literally scattered all around the globe. Just amazing where the Jews are. And that's what prophecies have been talking about, is that they're scattered. And here, this verse says that they're going to start coming back. And I want you to notice what it doesn't say. It doesn't say the remnant. He says the remainder of his brethren. And the idea is that they're coming back to the land, but it's not the remnant, it's not believing Israel. Not all of them are believing Israel. When you come to verse 4 now, verse 4 to the end of the chapter is about the establishment of peace. I'll remind you of the flow again. So as you go from chapter 4 into 5, he's talking about the tribulation. They lose their leader. In verses 2 and 3, he says, yeah, you lost your leader, but the Messiah is coming, right? And verse 2 and 3 is a prophecy that he's going to be born. Last part of 3 says, oh, and the Israelites are coming. Now, when you come to verse 4 through the rest of the chapter, it's what the Messiah is going to do. He's going to establish peace. So watch, the Israelites lost their leader, the Messiah is coming and going to establish peace. That is the message, and that is the encouragement. So verse 4, and we'll conclude our study. This will go quick now. And he will rise and shepherd his flock. That's talking about the shepherd king. Did you know that Jesus Christ, as the Messiah, is going to be not only king, but also a shepherd? Check out Isaiah chapter 40, verse 10 to 11. I won't go there. But you find out that God describes himself as being a shepherd. And I think Psalm 23 is a good description as well. So he's going to be a shepherd king. I like that. I like the idea that we're going to get a leader that's like a shepherd. Today we have leaders and they're dictators. We have leaders and they take advantage of us. This is going to be a king who's going to care about you. Going to care about me. And that's what he's going to be like. And he's going to do it in the strength of the Lord, in the majesty of the name of the Lord his God. And they will remain, talking about the Israelites, because at that time he will be great to the ends of the earth. Can I ask you a question? Do we have that today? He will be great to the ends of the earth. Is there somebody who is great to the ends of the earth, covers the whole earth? The answer is no. This is talking about the future reign of the Messiah here on earth. So you see what he's doing? He's encouraging them. Yes, they lost a leader. Oh, don't forget, there's the Messiah coming. And he's going to establish what? Peace, verse 5. And this one will be our peace. Prince of Peace, Isaiah 9:6. Now, he makes a very interesting statement that might cause some confusion. So let me explain what's going on. He says, and when the Assyrian invades our land, when he tramples on our, the New American Standard says citadels, it should be palaces. I don't know why they did citadels, but the better translation is palaces. And then we will raise against him 7 shepherds and 8 leaders of men. And then he goes on. He says, when the Assyrian invades our land. Some people said, this is history. This isn't the future. You're just confused. This is history. And I would like to say, no, it's not history. It's the future. And it's something important to notice. The Assyrian Empire, when it existed, it ended up sweeping down, taking control of the northern part of Israel. It actually had its territory go all the way over to the Persian Gulf. We talked about this already before. Moved up into Turkey and covers modern-day Syria and covers part of what today would be Iraq and Iran. So a number of geographic territories. If you were to go to the end of Daniel 11, we've talked about this before in the study in Daniel, you would find out that in Daniel 11, verses 40 to 46, that there are armies that come from what part of the world? From the territory that was once occupied by the Assyrian Empire. The armies come, we're told, actually from the north, and also from the south, and also from the east, and other prophecies coming out of Ezekiel 38, Ezekiel 39, that actually it's armies from what used to be the Assyrian Empire. That's what's being described here in verse 5. So when it says the Assyrian invades our land, it actually is talking about people coming from the old territory known as Assyria. It wouldn't be called Iraq and Iran. They did not exist back in those days. Those are modern-day terms for the territory known as the Assyrian Empire. So what's being described actually is the battle that occurs at the time of Armageddon. That's what Daniel 11, verses 40 through 46 is all about. So verse 6 of Micah 5. And they will shepherd the land of Assyria with a sword. I like that. That's kind of cute. They will shepherd the land of Assyria with a sword, as opposed with a hook. And the land of Nimrod at its entrances, and he will deliver us from the Assyrian when he attacks our land and when he tramples our territory. And then the remnant of Jacob will be among many peoples, like dew from the Lord, like showers on vegetation which do not wait for man or delay for the sons of men. And the remnant of Jacob will be among the nations, among many peoples, like a lion among the beasts of the forest, like a young lion among flocks of sheep, which if he passes through, tramples down and tears, and there is none to rescue. Your hand will be lifted up against your adversaries, and all your enemies will be cut off. Message: Messiah comes, helps Israel defeat the nations of the world. And then verses 10 through the rest of the chapter is nothing more than essentially a statement that the Messiah is going to destroy all the weapons of war. And that ends the chapter. Verse 10 says, "And it will be in that day, declares the Lord, that I will cut off your horses from among you and destroy your chariots." So he gets rid of the horses, gets rid of the chariots. "I will also cut off the cities of your land and tear down all your fortifications," talking about what he's going to do to the Assyrians. "I will cut off sorceries from your land, from your hand, and you will have fortune tellers no more. And I will cut off your carved images and your sacred pillars from among you, so that you no longer bow down to the work of your hands. I will root out your Asherim," that's an idol, "from among you and destroy your cities. And I will execute vengeance in anger and wrath on the nations which have not obeyed." So God says, I'm going to destroy the nations of the world that haven't obeyed. And God describes what he's going to do to them. Well, that's Micah chapter 4 and chapter 5. If you were Israel and you read that, you would go, wow. But I want you to think about something for a second. Why were they in anguish? Why were they crying out? Because they forgot the promises of God. I don't know about you, but one of my problems I have in life, when difficulty comes my way, is I start thinking about my problem. It takes me a little time to start thinking about how faithful God's been to me in the past. I forget that God's been there for me. God has made promises in Scripture for me. That's what apparently Israel had done. Apparently what Micah's revealing is that they got the message, the judgment was coming and it was unavoidable. And so they cried out. And Micah says, like, why are you doing that? I mean, think about the future of Israel. I mean, God has made these promises. So when we end up in trials and difficulties, what do we need to do? We need to remember that God has made promises to us. God has told us he won't leave us or forsake us. He's told us he'll meet our daily needs. God will take care of us. He tells us he defends the widow. He defends the orphan. God will take care of us. And we need to focus in and think about and cling to his promises when things get tough. Israel wasn't doing that. I think that's why chapters 4 and 5 were written, was to encourage the nation of Israel. And a great lesson for us, they weren't trusting the Lord. The Lord had told them Messiah was coming. The Lord told them there was going to be a millennial kingdom. God told them he was going to defend them. We need to remember the same things when we get into difficult situations in our life. Just cling to our God and go through it. Let's pray.